Good evening, and welcome to Movie Geeks United. I am Aaron Adidas, home entertainment editor and segment producer, filling in for Jamie Duvall, who is not with us for personal reasons, but he'll be back next week. And so I'm filling in for Jamie, and joining with me is the always personable Jerry. Jerry, how you doing?
I'm doing good. How are you doing, Aaron?
Oh, I'm pretty good.
Good.
So we got some cool stuff coming up for you. We're going to do a we've got an interview coming up in the second half of the show with the producer and filmmaker of a new documentary called Tales from the Script about screenwriting trade. That's going to be a fun interview. Jamie did that.
Mm-hmm.
But before we get into that, we're going to do some hot topics, some news. Jerry, why don't you pick it up?
All right. Why don't we talk about our thoughts about the Oscars?
Oscars.
You and I have not... Well, I've talked about it on another show I do. We've talked all about the Oscars. We actually did we didn't learn in film school podcast. We did a running commentary, Francis and I and some other people, on Sunday night, and then we did a recap on Monday. But I haven't really talked about it that much outside of that. And until I read Alec Baldwin's blog, I think it was yesterday, on Huffington Post,
mm-hmm.
I gotta say I had a really just sort of my usual, like, apathetic feeling, but then I read his blog, and I was like, you know, all right, I see where he's coming from. He's talking to a lot of people after the after parties and everything, and there's a really optimistic view of the whole evening and what happens to people afterwards. So, you know, I have a little bit better feeling about it, but I don't know, it just feels like it gets bogged down. I can't seem to get this thing streamlined at all. That's just
my initial
response so far.
Right. Well, I've always been kind of more or less open-minded about the Oscars in that, you know, a lot of people seem to have a short memory, and Jerry, you probably can back me up on this. You know, every year it's always, oh, the Oscars were too long, or this was a bad idea. You know, it's unfortunate, or maybe they're doing it because of this. You know, if the Academy would release those, like, 60s or 70s or 80s Oscar casts for people to see,
mm-hmm.
you know, there was never really a perfect Oscar cast. Yeah, you had the great host, Billy Crystal or
Johnny Carson.
Or Bob Hope.
Yeah.
But within those Oscar casts, you still had some really bad ideas or some bad segments. And, you know, in the 70s, you know, the golden age that everyone likes to talk about, you know, this is when they would have like 3-4 co-hosts, you know,
mm-hmm.
and really stiff, you know, Warren Beatty was a co-host one year. I mean, you know, you can only imagine how comfortable Warren Beatty was. I mean, so this has always been a thing about the Oscars, and people need to accept the fact the Oscars are never going to be quote-unquote short.
No,
they're
never.
Always going to be long. Just accept it.
It can't be short. If you have commercials and you have sponsors, your show is not going to be short. But you bring up a very good point. Back in the 70s and especially the 80s, when I really remember watching it, the show would usually start, if I'm not mistaken, like 8:30 or 9 o'clock on a Monday night, and would go well into like 1 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
From what I remember, because I remember, you know, you'd be allowed to stay up late and everything. It was a school night generally, and it would go on and on and on. So in one sense, it has been streamlined. I don't think it can get, you're right, much shorter. Now, the reason I bring this up is because on Friday night, for the first time in many years, because we finally got our cable provider, Comcast, had IFC back on this year, and I watched the Spirit Awards from beginning to end, a much shorter show, but you don't have to worry about commercials. So it usually runs about 2 hours and I think 15 minutes.
Right.
But they get to it really quickly. They get to the awards and everything. I will say this about the Oscars. They got it to supporting actor was the first one, and
mm-hmm.
they got that immediately this year. I was really amazed at that. But the Spirit Award seems much more streamlined than any other award show I've watched in recent memory. I can't say it was a great show, but it was fascinating to watch, though.
Well, yeah, but, you know, and also, in the one thing that the Indie Spirit Awards have, one, like you said, they have no real commercials,
mm-hmm.
so that streamlines it one thing. Their awards are pretty much performance and or, you know, directing award. They don't go into costume and sound mixing. So you got those categories streamlined.
Right.
And, you know, and also what's kind of funny, I mean, they're uncensored. So there's a little looser atmosphere. But, you know, the Oscars, I always have liked the Oscars, and there's always been low points. I mean, I think everyone's in agreement that this interpretive dance thing that was in the Oscars and, you know, brought it to a halt halfway through the show was just bad. I will say maybe it was one of those deals. If you saw it live in the theater, it was probably amazing, but most of us saw it on TV.
Yeah.
And they seem to do an interpretive dance thing like once a decade. I remember they did it in 98, 99 with like Saving Private Ryan.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And it's just never worked. The only one I remember liking a similar thing like this, I remember back, I guess it was 98,
mm-hmm.
when Whoopi hosts, they did that first thing, you know, the sound categories, I think with the people from Stomp. And they had like the images on the screen.
That's right, yeah.
You know, that was kind of fun.
Yeah.
But that's like the only time I've ever seen anything like that done. And for 2 years in a row, they blew the simple elegance of the In Memoriam section. They try to, you know, gloss it up a little, and it just, they did it last year, and they did it this year, and it just failed. And then the omission of some people this year.
This was awful this year. This was really bad. This was, and the rationale given was even worse. They were better off saying nothing than...
Yeah, Farrah Fawcett was more of a television person. I was like, she wasn't Logan's Run. She was in Dr. Teen and Women. And I vividly remember, Gary, you probably remember this too. Back in 86, there was a huge Oscar campaign for her work in Extremities,
mm-hmm.
which she got a Golden Globe nomination.
The thing that to omit her, I was really shocked at. That really caught me off guard. It just seems like they do this every year. There's always this one big, and I think this year it was actually several, because I don't think Dan O'Bannon, who passed away, who wrote Alien, was included either.
No, neither was Bea Arthur.
Bea Arthur. There's another, a huge personality, and you're not going to include her. This thing's got problems here. But I have to say, you sort of talk about the interpretive dance, and I thought it was awful. I really couldn't. I just kept rolling my eyes. But I don't think, if I'm not mistaken, I don't think they serve alcohol at the Kodak Theater.
Well, there is a bar, but it's not like the Golden Globes. They do have a bar that I know of the stars go to in commercial breaks or after their category has come and they've lost, they'll go to the bar.
No, because I was reading this book. I finished reading this book, Hellraisers, about O'Toole, Oliver Reed, Richard Harris, and Richard Burton. And there's a story about when Peter O'Toole went, had the Lifetime Achievement Award. I think it was in 2003, right when the Iraq War was going on. And he threatened to walk out because they didn't serve liquor at the bar, and they smuggled in some vodka for him to make sure he stayed. I don't know.
And here's one thing. Let me see if you get your opinion on this. And I've been defending it. And I think if you really know your film history and your Hollywood history, it makes absolute sense that they did this. I wish they'd gone a little further with it, but I had no problem with the John Hughes tribute.
Oh, I had no problem with it. I wish it was a little bit longer, actually.
And I wish they'd had more people. You know, people seem to forget, you have the Brat Pack that they like to call, but, I mean, you also had Chevy Chase and Michael Keaton
mm-hmm.
get their big breaks from John Hughes. I mean, Mr. Mom was Michael Keaton's first big hit, and that's a John Hughes script. And same thing with Chevy Chase with, the first Vacation film, John Hughes.
Chevy Chase, though, to be fair, though, had Foul Play and
right.
like Old Times and Caddyshack.
Right.
He was already very established, but the Vacation made him into a super... It was like what was the Vacation, and then I think it was 2 years later, Fletch made him into a superstar.
Right.
Jason O'Brien in our chat room, the host of Oscar, just brought up a very good point. They also omitted Ricardo Montalban. He was not on it either, and that's a huge, huge omission as well.
And the thing about, real quick to wrap up on this John Hughes thing, a lot of people have, you know, I've seen it on comments and, you know, message boards, you know, where was this tribute for, you know, Ingmar Bergman or you know, Fellini, you know, all the other greats who never got these kinds of tributes. And that is somewhat of a fair gripe, but...
It is a fair gripe.
But this is a, you know, producer, you know, producer by producer kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not the producers of this show, which was their first time producing it, it's not their fault that there was no Bergman or Fellini tributes. They had to do what they had with, and a tribute to John Hughes seemed very appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, whether, you know, like I said, film snobs can be snobs, but, you know, in the 80s and into the early 90s, John Hughes, you know, he was one of the biggest lights of Hollywood.
Well,
he kept it going.
You know, he's, you know, as we talked about this when his untimely death last summer, I mean, this is a guy who made films for teenagers and never spoke down to them. He never talked down to us, and I guess in Generation X, he never insulted us or condescended to us. There are a couple of filmmakers I can think of alive right now who do this very well, but and we're inspired by him, but we never felt like we were getting preached at.
Right.
And it's very important to bring that up. I think the reason, I hate to say this, but the reason you didn't have the tributes for those other directors, and I really... And it is a huge omission too. Is because I don't know if the producers went that far back in their film education. Sadly,
right.
If that's just, and I know I'm like sort of letting them get off the hook, but I honestly don't know if they went back that far,
mm-hmm.
which is a sad thing, a sad state of affairs. But it is a legitimate gripe. It's done. It's over with. And you know, it's. The least they could do for John Hughes.
Yeah, and so, but all in all, I didn't think it was a bad Oscar ceremony. I mean, it was fine. Actually, I did like last year's a little more, and a lot of people don't like it. I actually like the way they're doing the acting categories with the people coming out.
I must be the only person who doesn't like that because I feel like they're reading their eulogy almost. I mean,
I don't see it as eulogy. I see it as paying tribute. And frankly, I find it kind of fun when you know, they say the actors and you quickly start doing a kind of a parlor game of like, well, who's going to talk about who? Like when Michelle Pfeiffer came out,
mm-hmm.
I thought she was going to do George Clooney because of One Fine Day.
Yeah,
and then. And then it turned out to be Jeff Bridges, and I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, I remember that. I was probably the only one in my house, and probably a lot of people, only a couple people around the country, knew when Forrest Whitaker came out, like, oh, that's Sandra Bullock. And I'm sure I'm sure a lot of people were like, why is Forrest Whitaker doing it? I only wish they hadn't omitted it for the supporting. I would have liked to have...
I just got the impression it was more that it was felt like they were eulogizing to me, just to me, my own perception. So I wasn't quite, but I did like though of that, even though I don't like the way they do. I did like for Jeremy Renner, they brought Colin Farrell out from SWAT, which
that
I thought
was awesome.
A nice touch. But yeah, I'm not crazy about that thing. On the other thing though, I have to say, would had it been so bad to let Roger Corman say something?
Yeah, I mean, it is kind of a ironic sick joke that, you know, the first year that they decide to not have the honorary Oscars in the ceremony is the year that they give the honorary Oscar to probably, you know, the one of the few people who more or less is probably responsible for the vast majority of the people.
That's right.
Who make
those
up Hollywood.
People wouldn't have a job if it wasn't for Roger Corman. They'd be waiters or bartenders. They would never, or whatever, they would never have been, I mean, he gave, especially someone like James Cameron, Roger Corman, you know, he really gave a lot of these people their big breaks. And to not let him speak at the actual ceremony I thought was criminal. But, you know, that's not up to me to say. So,
but, you know, I keep telling people, you know, they could have done a lot of things with that 8 minutes that they gave to the interpretive dance. And also, I love the idea of acknowledging the importance of horror to Hollywood.
Yeah.
But the simple truth is that what makes horror great you know, the money shots in horror, they couldn't really show in that montage because you're on, you know, you're on network TV, so you can't show the, you know, the great scenes from all the horror films.
Would you, have had the kids from Twilight do it?
Yeah.
Now, that's the thing. That's a bone of contention with a lot of diehard horror fans. While they are really happy that finally that the Academy acknowledged horror, it's that they have the kids from Twilight. But that's also, we know, to get that demographic to watch it, too.
I do not participate in anything remotely of Twilight bashing. Having them do it is fine. You know, a lot of people are going to eat their words, I feel, if after the Twilight films are over, if a handful of these, of the actors from the Twilight series go on to big things. I mean, would they be complaining if, I mean, these are the same type of people who would have been complaining if, if the Jane Fonda from Barbarella was presenting a prestigious award and people would be saying, well, who's this Jane Fonda person? You know, that type, you know, it's a similar thing. Everyone has to start from somewhere. And the Twilight films are not bad films. They're not, you know, they're not masterpieces. But
no, they're
they
not
are
made for us. They're made for a certain demographic. That's how I look at it. I mean, they're made for...
Well, all movies are made for a certain...
Hey, but this one, these are really made for demographic. And I always almost feel it's not fair for me. Now, I've seen I have seen both Twilight films so far, but they're really not made for me. And I realize that. I'm curious about them. I think of all the, I mean, Kristen Stewart had a very, has had a career before these movies, and I think she'll have a career long after these movies.
Look at Anna Kendrick, who had a big part in the Twilight movie, and she's already an Oscar nominee.
Yeah, she's an Oscar nominee, and also before that, she was in a really good movie called Rocket Science, long before Twilight, and, you know, I think she'll go far, too. Look, it's got to be a nice paycheck, okay? Mm-hmm. It's got to be a really nice paycheck. But I do think Stewart is going to have a very, just doing her work in Adventureland alone, or even Into the Wild, or The Cake Eaters, I think she's going to have a very long career ahead of her. She knows how to really handle herself in a lot of really difficult roles so far, so, and I'm really curious to see her in Runaways.
I hear she's the best thing in The Runaways.
Yeah, that's what I've been hearing. So, I think, you know, I guess you have to, if you're the Academy, and we look at the way they think, if you have the people from Twilight is the best way to do this, because those movies are, you know, they're juggernauts. I mean, you're going to get a lot of people watching your show if you have Taylor Lautner and
I mean, look at it this way. Jamie once told me this, and I had forgotten all about this. I mean, Steven Seagal presented an award at the Oscars one year. So if Steven Seagal can present an award, I think, you know, Taylor Lautner and...
Yeah, I mean, and you heard what Steven Seagal wants to do. He wants to do his own version of The Hurt Locker. Now,
yeah.
I heard that today. I don't even want to go into that.
I love it. I want to see it. I want to see it. I want to see him whispering throughout the whole movie. Well, I mean, so I think overall it was an okay Oscar cast. I actually liked Baldwin and Martin. I think as the show went on, they got better. They got looser. I'm sure there was some alcohol in the back. That loosened them up. I loved the George Clooney on-running gag, which I knew was an on-running gag. I can't believe people actually thought there was something actually wrong with Clooney.
Right. No, I got a very good sense of humor. I don't. Yeah, I couldn't believe that. You know, it had to be a gag, just the way he would have, or else he would have gotten up and said something.
Yeah. So I mean, I thought it was good. I think if I have correctly, I got 17 out of 24 categories.
You missed them?
Yeah, I missed.
I didn't think you missed any.
No, I missed some. I tell you, and my biggest misses were the screenwriting. I missed both of the screenwriting. I thought Up in the Air was going to get adapted screenplay because it had been winning that the whole time, but Precious pulled it out. So I was happy. It was a happy upset for me. And I know Hurt Locker had been winning,
right?
But I had known that Inglourious Basterds hadn't qualified for like the WGA award,
right?
Because,
mm-hmm.
So I assumed when it got into the Oscars, more people could vote for it. So I thought Inglourious Basterds was going to pull away and win original screenplay.
Yeah, that was the one thing that caught me off guard. Even though Hurt Locker had won the WGA, but given the rationale that you were giving, I thought that the original screenplay was Tarantino's. I really did. That was the one thing that caught me off guard. I was like, wow. I knew Precious was going to win because it won at the Spirit. It's not that they're the same people voting or anything, but I just figured that the momentum was going towards Precious in that category. Up in the Air, like, peaked so early in one sense. And I like Up in the Air. I know some people really, it's the in thing to rag on it, but I enjoyed Up in the Air.
I love Up in the Air. I don't want to get into it too much, but I do think audiences have devolved or evolved, however you want to look at it, that I think now, because it's all about sensation and spectacle, I do think a lot of audiences, even adult audiences, have forgotten or are unwilling to realize when a movie is not a spectacle, but it's not small, but it actually has a steadiness and a momentum that's not building up to some grand twist or some grand anything, but just kind of this epiphany and has, you know, one of these life goes on endings, very 70s style. And I think audiences today they're kind of being made uncomfortable by that. And I think they're forgetting that, you know, some filmmakers still want to leave it up to you. This is the same kind of ending that, you know, you saw in something like comparable to California Split.
Yeah. Oh, no, this is something that goes back, well, I mean, even long before that. I mean, there is a twist, but it's a very adult twist. It is something that I did not see. I was thinking there was something coming in regards to his situation with Vera Farmiga, but that it would be that kind of floored me, but I thought that was perfect. I thought that revealed this whole duality, these separate lives that people live in this, in the job, you know, between work and the private life.
Right.
And I thought that was, I mean, it really, for me, sort of sealed the deal for me that this is a really good, really solid film.
Mm-hmm.
And I do agree with that, like the life goes on ending. It's an adult, how shall I say this without, oh God, the movie's been out a long time. It's out on Blu-ray, I think, this week. So it's an adult version of 500 Days of Summer. I mean, she pulls a Summer Finn on him. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
She really does. I mean, and I thought that was like, wow. But I thought that was a well-made, and you're right, there is. We have, and it's not, that's not a new thing. There's always been spectacle, but it does seem like the last couple of years of the advent of technology and everything, people just want to really, I hate to use this expression, but they do want to shut their brains off when they enter the theater.
Mm-hmm.
I really think, I think you're absolutely right. Just look at the number one movie this weekend.
Oh, yeah. Well, speaking of, I have not seen Alice in Wonderland. I probably will. I will say my one caveat is that if I do see it, I'll probably just see it in 2D. I saw Avatar in 3D, and it was terrific. You know, it's a fun, entertaining film, but I also got a headache. And I'm kind of, you know, I'm over 3D. I think the next 3D film I will pay the extra money and go see. I will go see Tron Legacy in 3D.
Oh, you're not going to try Clash of the Titans?
No.
Okay. I just thought I'd ask.
I don't think that or Robin Hood. You know, I'm not going to.
Is Robin Hood in 3D?
I've heard they're going to retrofit it for 3D.
Okay, this is the what I liked about Avatar was I felt like I was actually in the movie. The problem with Alice in Wonderland, this is going to be the problem coming with any of these 3D films, I think, afterwards, with probably the exception of Tron Legacy, is that I do feel like it's the old school where it feels like someone is throwing something at you almost. I don't think Alice in Wonderland is as horrible as everyone makes it out to be, but it is this a lesser Tim Burton film. He really has gotten hooked on these remakes as of late, and it shows. I mean, I don't it's very, this was so derivative of so many other movies. I just got to say, I mean, yeah, visually it has some neat things in it, but overall I just couldn't get worked up for it. I really couldn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it is kind of interesting that this is coming out on the 25th anniversary of Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
I wish he would go back to making those movies. Those are so good. And it's not that his work with Depp is bad. Just I loved Sweeney Todd. But I got to say, ever since he did that thing, the Planet of the Apes remake, something has, I would thought he would have learned after that to maybe stay away. Then he did Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, which I just thought went on too long. Some sequences, you know, just kept going on and on. And this one, Allison one, I don't know what to say after a while.
Yeah.
And I think he's doing Sleeping Beauty next, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, is he?
I
wish he would do that Ripley's Believe It or Not story,
mm-hmm,
that he was going to do with Jim Carrey years ago.
Yeah,
I think
that would be perfect for him.
I think that would have been fun. But, yeah, like I said, the next IMAX 3D I'll do is Tron, which, of
okay,
course, the official trailer came out this week. Hit the internet,
mm-hmm,
if you will. It's exciting. I guess, you know, it's kind of funny. I was telling someone, you know, that I think that's going to be, you know, a huge hit come Christmas time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Jeff Bridges, oddly enough, is probably going to be Entertainment Weekly's Entertainer of the Year at the end of the year between Crazy Heart, Tron, and True Grit. And
mm-hmm,
I love the fact that the original Tron, it's obviously going to come out on Blu-ray toward, around that time, Thanksgiving,
right,
Christmas. So finally, people will, a vast majority of people will actually get to see Tron. You know, people like to say, oh, yeah, Tron, but, you know, honestly, I don't think the vast majority of people have even actually truly seen the original Tron. It's still it's one of those films people know about, but I don't think a lot of people still have even seen it.
Well, I think people in our age saw it in the theater, or when it first came on home video. I remember I saw it in the theater, and it was neat, and I remember all the Tron arcade games and everything that were in the arcades at the time. I don't have like I was saying, I think on last week's show, I don't have the huge nostalgia that a lot of my contemporaries have for the original. I'm not saying I don't like the original film, but it's not something that this was not something I was clamoring for. But then I saw the trailer in front of Alice in Wonderland. I was kind of really blown away by by that trailer. I was like, okay, this looks much more promising than I ever thought. So I'm with you there. I would actually try to go out of my way and see it in IMAX.
Yeah, and I mean, it's kind of fun. Jeff Bridges
mm-hmm,
going back to, you know, this is kind of I'm sure Kurt Russell is probably going to start slapping himself, because if Tron Legacy is half as good as we think it could be, Jeff Bridges is going to have a better time going back to the well with the Flynn character than Kurt Russell did with Snake Plissken.
You're talking about Escape from L.A.
You know, that was one of those deals, and it just, basically it was Escape from New York, but it was on the West Coast. There was nothing new, nothing different.
I was looking so forward to Escape from L.A., and I know I'm in the minority because there are people who like it a lot. I was really disappointed in Escape from L.A. because I like the Escape from New York so much, but I did feel for a good chunk of the film, it was, you know, not what I thought it would be. When I originally read about the project, I think it was in 1986, 10 years before it came out, I was like, wow, this sounds really promising. And then when it finally, you know, makes it to theaters, it just doesn't, it's almost, I want to say, it felt dated.
Yeah.
In some aspects. I love the original Escape from New York, but the sequel I just felt was one of those, like, Phantom Menace level disappointments for me.
Well, it's a shame because, oddly enough, you know, I never thought Escape from New York really set itself up for a sequel, where obviously Big Trouble in Little China was most definitely set up for, you know,
I would love to see a sequel to that. I would still actually, you know, like to see something with that character again.
Yeah. So any other topics?
Everyone woke up this morning to the news.
All right.
The untimely death of
Corey Haim.
And at 38, what we believe is a drug overdose. I think, has that been verified now? Because I haven't been checking.
Hasn't been verified. The I just read recently, like a little bit ago, the agent is doubting intentional overdose.
Oh, okay.
Maybe it'll turn out to be something like the Brittany Murphy thing.
Well, we're still finding out. Like every week, there's like they keep updated results of an autopsy, and I mean, this is really getting. I personally think, you know, I know a lot of people are very apathetic, very cynical, and just, oh, we knew, you know, because he's fallen on hard times, so people say, oh, this doesn't surprise me. I think it's sad. This is, someone from our youth, the Lost Boys, License to Drive, Lucas, someone who had the whole world was at his fingertips for a time there, along with Corey Feldman, for that matter. And, you know, in the 90s, I guess, in the mid to late 90s, we watched it slip away. And then they did that reality show a couple of years ago, the two Coreys.
Right.
And, they had the Lost Boys sequel that came out. Were they both in the Lost Boys sequel? I haven't seen it yet, so you got to forgive me. I just haven't gotten around to seeing
it. He has one scene at the end.
Okay.
Corey Haim.
Oh.
And it's funny, you bring up Lost Boys, and my Facebook status, my tribute to Corey Haim was quoting Reservoir Dogs. which paid tribute to the Lost Boys.
Right.
Bring up Lucas, and Lucas is a lost kind of gem of a film. And, I'm sure hopefully people will rediscover it with Corey Haim.
I think that's a given now because everyone's bringing it up in all their posts and everything. But
What's interesting about Lucas, and I just saw it like a year ago, a couple of things are interesting. One, Winona Ryder, I think it's one of her earliest, maybe her earliest screen debut. I mean, this is pre-Heather's Great Balls of Fire.
It is. I mean, because I think, if I want to say, 1986.
Yeah, so you have that, and you have a great tender performance by Charlie Sheen.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone has this image of Charlie Sheen, even kind of the Fast Lane, Wall Street, No Man's Land, Charlie Sheen, but
right.
I think people will be shocked at how great he is in Lucas.
How he was in in enough movies before Platoon, and before he was Oliver Stone's alter ego in those two films. I remember him from junior high and high school, watching him. So, Lucas is another really good, you're absolutely right, one of these lost films from the 80s get discovered.
The other interesting thing about Lucas is that, I don't know if this is sad or kind of darkly funny or just something to take note of, that if you were to remake Lucas without changing anything today and just keep the structure of that film, the audience would assume that that film would end with Lucas becoming a high school shooter. Because I remember when I saw it, when I was watching it, like I said, a little over a year ago, and I'm watching the stuff that happens to Lucas. The character of Lucas that Corey Haim plays, he's an overachiever.
Mm-hmm.
He's super smart, but he's small, and he's skipped a grade, so he's younger than most people. So most of the football team picks on him, and everyone ostracizes him. He does befriend one girl, but the girl prefers the quarterback instead of Lucas. And so all this stuff kind of happened, and he had a broken home and all this other stuff. And I kept thinking, it's like, well, this made today, he would get a shotgun at some point.
I didn't even think about it, but that's an interesting observation with today's times.
Corey Haim, he had some talent. License to Drive is a fun, this tied us back to John Hughes. I mean, License to Drive was, and Lucas are obvious films that were green lit because of John Hughes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And License to Drive is very much in that Ferris Bueller Weird Science mold, and a pre-Roller Girl Heather Graham.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Right. And Lost Boys, back when Kiefer Sutherland wasn't out of breath.
God. You're right. You're right about that. Okay. That was before Flashback. That was before. Because he was in
Flatliners, man. Flatliners.
Yes.
I was talking to Jamie, and We pinpoint Kiefer's out of breath acting mode to Flatliners.
Okay, I'll have to keep that in mind the next time I watch Flatliners.
He's out of breath. Now, granted, he's died, and so he comes back to life. But
yeah, I mean,
still, he's out of breath a lot through that film.
Okay.
He controls his breathing more in Young Guns.
True.
So, yeah, so Corey Haim, you know, and it's weird, you know, this 80s thing, I mean, between Corey Haim and Michael Jackson and Patrick Swayze, I mean.
Patrick Swayze, yeah. I mean, a lot of great ones, a lot of great ones over the last year.
It's just a weird thing going on now with the, you know, I was telling someone, you know, it's like the 80s, particularly in this year, 2010, is really this is the year where the 80s come back with a vengeance.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not just with remakes and reboots, you know, Nightmare on Elm Street, A-Team, Karate Kid, Clash of the Titans, Wall Street, Tron, but then you're getting these films that try to be a throwback or an homage to some of these, to the 80s aesthetics. I mean,
yes.
I just saw Kevin Smith's Cop Out, which is not a very good film, but I mean, it is.
I mean, that's a shame right there, that it's not all it could be. It's definitely not all it could be. But it is like Running Scared, 48 Hours, and those types of films. He's definitely going for that.
The best thing in Cop Out is that Kevin Smith got Harold Faltermeyer to do the score.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which is, as I told my brother as I was leaving the theater, I go, well, that score is more Tango and Cash than Beverly Hills Cop, but it gets the point across. But, you know,
right.
not only with Cop Out, you know, Stallone has The Expendables coming out in August, which
and
is kind of
hot
a
Hot Tub Time Machine.
Yeah, and Hot Tub Time Machine.
That's
you know,
out in the chat room, yeah.
So, I mean, it's as if, and I was telling someone, with this John Hughes tribute at the Oscars, I'm wondering, my theory is that the people who came of age in the 80s, they're now the creative people, air quotes around that, in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think that's one of the reasons we're getting this rebooting, you know, repackaging of 80s. I mean, we've already had, and not only that, but you know, in the pipeline, we have, you know, a Footloose. We have a 21 Jump Street, Ghostbusters 3.
Ghostbusters 3, I'm curious about because it was something for the longest time Bill Murray would not touch. He refused to do it. I mean, just would never do it. And
Alimony
really
will make you reconsider things.
Yeah.
You know, so like
Red
I said.
Red Dawn. Don't forget we have a Red Dawn remake.
Oh, Red Dawn. You know, and on TV we have Parenthood now. And like I said,
Conan is coming back, a reboot of Conan. So
reboot of Conan, you know, and like I said, Footloose is coming back, and so it's all in the air, and this is the year where it seems that the '80s are the '80s are back, baby.
Yeah, no, they're back. And remember, last year we had a Fame remake.
We had Fame and
a short-lived one, but yeah, that was there. I think everyone expected that to do much better than it did, but right. You're absolutely right. I think this is a year where it's going to be very much like that.
And I must admit, I'm kind of excited because I think a reassessment of the '80s is time has come for that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, '80s have always been the whipping boy for filmmakers and critics and pundits. Because, you know, it paled in comparison to the 70s. And, yes, it does. But also, I do think the 80s have their merits. I will take summer of 84, summer of 86 over summer, you know, 2006, 2005, you know.
I don't know if I take it over 2005. I might definitely take it over 2006, though. Because to me, 2006 really... It had a really good spring and a really good fall, but the summer had a lot of disappointments from what I remember that year. But I did like 2005 a lot. I won't lie to you all the whole year. But though I understand what you're saying, and I think the thing with the 80s though is I look at it like this: you have enough distance now in the last couple of years, especially us Generation Xers, Gen Xers is the appropriate term, I guess, but we can look back, and there is a certain sense of nostalgia. And I can pinpoint, I think, at least for me, I can pinpoint it like this. We were in school, high school and college, and while I'm not a big on high school or anything, in college there was a certain adult, we weren't adults yet. We didn't have to worry about bills. We didn't have to worry about this recession. We didn't have to worry about anything. And there's a certain nostalgia for that. And I understand that completely with the some of the revival of the music, and especially with the remakes and the reboots and all that. It makes perfect sense looking back at it. We've had this distance, and there is a, I understand nostalgia more than I've ever understood it before.
Yeah, and you know, and it's funny, you know, even this, you know, last year we had the reboot of Star Trek, and the funny thing to me about J.J. Abrams' Star Trek is that it owes more to the Nicholas Meyer Star Treks than it ever does to the TV show. You know,
the Nicholas Meyer ones are very, I think Nicholas Meyer ones were the best.
Yeah, I mean,
as far as the movies go, but yeah, it does owe to that. And but to be fair to Nicholas Meyer, he was also, you know, took what was great about the show and put it into his films. But Nicholas Meyer, I mean, he made the Time After Time and the 7% Solution, a very, very creative filmmaker and writer. So his Star Treks are just unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, he did two. He directed 2 and 6, and worked on the screenplays for 3 and 4, if I'm not mistaken. You know, so I mean,
I miss his involvement.
You know, and so the last thing I'll say about this, what's interesting is that, you know, the 80s are almost 30 years old. You know, we're almost...
Yeah, man, don't remind me, please.
But,
please don't
but here, here's me. The thing. You know, and someone told me this, and I hadn't thought about it, but and then when they pointed out, it makes it, I understood what they're saying, is that, you know, when Dazed and Confused came out in 1993, you know, that, and it took place in 1976, and that was a 17-year gap. And so when we saw Dazed and Confused, it seemed like it was so long ago, 1976.
Right.
But here, with a movie like, you know, last year, my favorite film of the year was Adventureland.
Yeah.
Which took place in 1987. And then we have Hot Tub Time Machine, which is going to take place in 1986, which are both films take place in, you know, 20-plus years ago. And yet, they don't feel that long ago. It's as if the 80s, in a weird way, you know, we thought they, maybe we repressed them, but it's as if the 80s never went anywhere.
No. God, you really bring up, that's probably why Adventureland, I haven't seen Hot Tub Time Machine yet, so I can't, I only know what I know from the trailer, but Adventureland, one of the things that really, because I know where I was at the time that movie took place. I know all too well what I was doing and everything, and I just remember feeling like that. Now, remember, at that time, I was, a junior or senior in high school. It wasn't, I wasn't after college, but I could definitely relate to the after college part. But his whole relationship with his friends and his coworkers and everything, that film, and I've seen very good coming-of-age films this decade. I'm not going to go into them, but I thought Adventureland certainly was a victim, as we've talked about in the show, marketed the wrong way, but one of the best coming-of-age dramas I've seen in probably 30 years. It just hit so close to the bone. It was just brilliant. I can't believe it was written off by so many people.
Right, right.
I went back and saw it the next day. I went to see it Friday night, and then went back Saturday morning to see it again. Because I was just thunderstruck by how good it was. I mean, this was not in a trailer. They definitely want to advertise it as super bad or something, and it's bad at all. And I was just thunderstruck. And there's some very important scenes in that movie, and I do love the scene where he really, you know, points out that Ryan Reynolds is full of it at the end. I love that. I just think, and I also think it's an excellent role from Reynolds. But that's just, I mean, I really admire you for saying that's the best film of last year, or your favorite, because it definitely is one of the three films I really loved last year. You know, it's very powerful filmmaking, without a doubt.
Right. Well, I think we've gone a little too long, but, you know,
I
get the feeling we're probably going to be returning to the 80s many times throughout the year on this show.
Yeah.
When all these films start coming in. But we should probably get to our interview.
I think we should. That's what all these good people are here for, so we might as well give them what they want. All
right. So let's hear. The art of screenwriting is broken down by the writers themselves in the new film Tales from the Script, which features keen insights of nearly 50 of our top screenwriters, including Paul Schrader and Frank Darabont. The film opens in New York on March 12th and L.A. on March 19th, and a companion book of the film is also available. Our host and creator, producer of our show, Jamie Duvall, spoke with writer, producer, director Paul Hansen, I believe a couple weeks ago. And so here is Jamie's interview with writer, producer, director Paul Hansen about the art of screenwriting.
Write a great script. I mean, that's the simplest thing in the world to say. It's the hardest thing in the world to do. What's more fragile than a story?
You can finalize and fine-tune a script down to the nth degree, and it's uninspiring.
Bull Durham has the famous speech. I wrote it just to get a movie star, and it worked.
Had these long series of talks with Stanley Kubrick.
I've been lucky to make three movies now with Tim Burton.
The movie I had in mind is not the movie that George Lucas had in mind.
I said, Joel, did you read the script? And he said, well, I was exposed to it.
There was this experience on Air Force One where I had written this little speech, and Harrison came up to me and he said, it's a great speech. I said, oh, thank you. He said, I'm not going to do it.
Screenwriting is kind of invisible.
It's really not as glamorous as you might imagine.
Your job is to get punched in the face.
The Grudge was my first film. That was my 25th screenplay.
I would say that about 20% of what I wrote is on the screen.
Not getting credit on that movie probably cost me $500,000.
If you want to write movies, you can't stop after you get pissed on and rejected, because you're going to get pissed on and rejected.
That comment, which to you means nothing, it's like, are you insane? Shut up. You know, that to them, that was their day, was the comment.
If they want somebody else to work on it, there's nothing you can do about it. Learn to love it.
Coppola told me after he made The Godfather, he said, I can fail for 10 years now.
It's hard to find a Shawshank every time you make a movie. If it were easy, everybody would be making Shawshank.
I think the public would be shocked to see how many movies that end up horrific started out as pretty good screenplays.
You have to be able to watch a director do the horrible thing that happens to a script, which is unravel it.
A writer friend of mine once described screenwriters as egomaniacs with low self-esteem.
I always feel that when a movie sucks, it's my fault.
This is a last laugh business.
It's a lot of fun, and it's the hardest thing I'll ever do.
I've been a movie geek, to quote the name of the show, for all of my life. My parents often regale me with stories of me as an infant watching King Kong and Godzilla on Saturday afternoon matinees on television, and luckily my taste in cinema has become at least marginally more sophisticated in the intervening years. But the love I have for the power of the moving image has been a driving force in my entire professional life. So I went to film school at NYU with every intention of becoming the next great, wonderful director, only to discover that even though I may in fact have been great and wonderful, the world in fact was not waiting with bated breath for my powerful cinematic statements. So once reality set in and I realized I had to make a living before I could conquer the world, I fell back into something I had been doing since high school, which was journalism, specifically entertainment journalism. So I spent about 10 years working as a reporter and critic in upstate New York, and that led to me writing my first couple of books. And by the time my first couple of books were done, I had already dipped my toe into the independent film waters and was able to take full advantage of the digital filmmaking revolution. So the first feature that I made was actually a regional feature about digital filmmaking, and that sort of broke the ground for me to make a short, and then eventually this new film, Tales from the Script.
Yeah, and so when you approach film,
or anything from a creative standpoint? Do you approach it first and foremost from a writer's perspective, a director's perspective, or can you quantify that?
It depends on who you ask. If you ask me, I say that I'm a filmmaker first, and if you ask my wife, who is generally right about most things, I'm a writer first. So mm-hmm. I like to think of myself as being both at the same time. And I can't quantify it. That's a really good choice of words because they overlap so closely. And here's what I mean. When I'm writing a screenplay, for instance, I'm obviously very focused on the play of language. I'm very focused on story structure. I'm very focused on the use of literary devices. I'm approaching it as a writer. But at the same time, every script I write, whether I plan to try and make it myself or whether I plan to put it out for other people to make it, I'm always thinking in terms of how it actually gets shot. And I'm thinking in terms of what are the visual possibilities of this particular scene, this particular story. So I think it's that conflict between those two creative impulses mm-hmm. that helps me approach the work in an exciting and vibrant way. And I'm not completely unique in this by any stretch of the imagination, but I'm a writer in as much as if I'm looking at a scene, my first instinct might be to have a character expound in some wonderful flowery monologue, but my first instinct as a filmmaker is to say, how can I tell this story with pictures? And I think by being able to use both of those tools, being able to tell a story visually and being able to tell a story with traditional language, I hope that I have a powerful approach that combines both of those strengths.
Well, your works, they're all fantastic and they're fascinating. You've written about Dalton Trumbo and digital filmmaking and the Generation X of filmmakers. How did the notion of a book documentary combo concerning screenwriting come about?
Sure. I had obviously always entertained the idea of doing a book about screenwriting, but never really had a focus for it until I ran across a web designer who did some work for me, a guy named Paul Herman, and he had the notion of doing a project that explored the rejection that screenwriters experience in their career. I thought that was a pretty good hook. I jumped on board, and as the project grew, I decided I wanted to explore a broader range of subject matter instead of just one aspect of the screenwriting life.
Mm-hmm.
And what Tales from the Script ended up being for me is kind of a virtual panel discussion, both in the book and the film, in which a range of screenwriters, both everyone from people who are beginning their careers to people who have seen their careers run possibly their entire course, it's as if they're all sitting in a room chatting about everything that screenwriters encounter. So the cheap joke that I've used before about the script is it's a scientific study of the life cycle of a screenwriter from pupa to carcass.
Yeah. It's a fantastic movie and so many great, almost 50 screenwriters are involved in this project. Did you have a wish list and you just started making phone calls? Is that how you assembled this group?
The way I assembled the group was twofold. The first was cataloging the what I would call the most obvious names, which are the brand names, the Oscar winners, the people who are working really steadily right now, the people we closely associate with blockbusters. Adding to that list were some veterans, people whose work I really admire, but who may not be as familiar to contemporary audiences right now. Once I had that master list, I thought, well, okay, that's pretty big, but I also wanted to add into that yet another dimension, which is I wanted to make sure that represented in that group were both persons who speak to the experience of being a minority writer, be they mm-hmm. women or writers of color, but I also wanted to add into that mix people whose careers have not become familiar to the general public yet. Because I think that those writers who are relatively new, there's a gentleman named Ari B. Rubin, who's the son of the Oscar-winning screenwriter Bruce Rubin. Ari has sold scripts and he's worked at studios, but he has not yet had a film made. And I think his experience is probably going to echo much more powerfully with a lot of people who see this film, who maybe aspire to write films or just getting started, but they really can't relate to the experience of someone who has two Oscars on their shelf and who gets paid $1 million a script. I wanted to have both in there because I think by having the interplay between people who are just beginning their careers and people who have become firmly established, you're able to arrive at almost a mathematical median. This is something that, and these following experiences happen to everybody. These happen to beginners, these happen to veterans, and therefore if I embark on this career, I will more likely than not encounter such and such experience. Mm-hmm. I really wanted it to be a book about everyone who does screenwriting, not just the rock stars.
You know, and so then, much...
I didn't answer the second half of your question. And it was a good question in terms of the approaching, but yes, absolutely. Once I had the master list, the people I went after were people who were either friends of friends or I knew some way to get to them. In a lot of cases, I would literally just go to events where people were speaking publicly, introduce myself and solicit their participation. And in other cases, I would go the formal route of inviting them through their agents. So I used whatever means were available to bring the people into the project that I brought in.
Yeah. You know, so much of it is rejection, as you mentioned. And executives and such making ill-advised, ill-informed changes and to the script and the material, and you have to have a tough skin. And I guess it's a kind of a two-part question: why do they do it, and what characteristics do they all share? What common characteristics do they all have?
I'll actually answer that question backwards because those are both really key themes in this project, and I think you've really gotten to the heart of what makes this book valuable for people who are thinking about screenwriting careers. The answer to the second part of the question, what keeps them going, I think is tenacity. That's the theme that I identified pretty early as being the common characteristic to people who are able to survive and thrive in screenwriting. Mm-hmm. Because you're rejected at every stage. When you're first setting out to write, people tell you your writing isn't good enough or that the career is too hard or that you should do something more realistic for a living. Let's say you get your first success. You win a contest. You get noticed. You get an agent. Then you have to climb the hurdle of getting the first thing sold. Then you have to climb the hurdle of getting the first thing made. Then you have to begin the process all over again. And guess what? Somewhere in that mix, people are going to tell you that this screenplay that's so wonderful that it won a contest, got sold, and got put into production needs to be changed because of a good reason. We don't have enough days to shoot the big chase scene you wanted, or a bad reason. The actor doesn't like this monologue and doesn't think he can perform it well, so it needs to be cut. Mm-hmm. So it really is an endurance test for anybody who sets out to do screenwriting, and I think one thing that becomes clear looking at the movie and reading the book is that this tenacity is called upon by people at every stage of their careers, not just the beginners, because I think that's a comforting notion we give to ourselves as people who are beginning screenwriting careers, that once we become established, once we become the Oscar-winning rock star, somehow everything will magically become easier and people will film our work exactly as written, and that's just not the case. People who've been through the mill for 20, 30 years are suffering the same vicissitudes as beginners who are just storming the gates. So that's number one. Tenacity is the quality that binds people who can survive all of this. And then underlying it is the other half of your question, why do people do it? And I think this is what gives people that tenacity. This is what empowers their strength. People do this because they love story. People do this because they have stories in them that they think they can share, and people do this because they love the medium so deeply that it doesn't matter what they're going to endure dealing with the people who control the gates of that particular medium. If you want to make movies, you want to make movies. You're in love with cinema. You're in love with the abstraction, the ethereal notion of this art form and what this art form can be, and you're in love with the idea of recreating in other people the impact that the movies you love had on you. That's an incredibly powerful driving force. And when you look at it in that context, you're dealing with something that's much bigger than you and you want to be a part of it, then it puts the silliness of bad notes from a development executive or egotistical behavior by a director into context. You're chasing a very big dream.
Has the writer's position on the food chain, and this is discussed in your film, but just for the benefit of our listeners, has that changed at all for the worse or for the better over the years?
It's the writer's position in Hollywood is absolutely cyclical. There's a lot of history behind it, and that's a whole other interview with someone who's smarter than I am about the long and winding road that the Screenwriters Guild and now the Writers Guild of America has charted since the 1930s. Where we are right now is that writers occupy a really peculiar moment. I think we're exiting the period during which movie stars call the shots in Hollywood. We're seeing a lot of movies like The Hangover that are not star-driven. We're seeing movies like Avatar that are not star-driven, with the exception of the fact that in that case the director is the star.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we're getting back to a point where concept is what is selling movies. If the studio can present to the audience a one-line description of a movie that sounds interesting to them, it's The Day After a Wild Night in Vegas and Here's What Happens, or it's A Three-Hour Journey of Fantastical Blue People in 3D. If that one idea can convince people to come see a movie, they don't really care who's in it anymore. And they don't care how much it costs, they don't care if it's low budget or big budget. If they can be seduced into seeing a movie, that can get them excited. The trick for the screenwriter is that the screenwriter often is the person who has come up with that seed. So there is an opportunity now for writers, I think, to position themselves a little better. But there's an X factor here, which is this. Part and parcel with the growth of this concept-driven marketing, which is not a new idea, but which is, I think, becoming more and more refined where we are right now,
mm-hmm.
is the idea that pre-sold concepts have more value in Hollywood than brand new concepts. So they're going to pay Taylor Lautner $7.5 million to appear in a movie of Stretch Armstrong based on the old toy. I think we can say that this is probably not going to be a movie driven by a deeply felt, passionate screenplay. So it's a weird moment for writers. You have a movie like The Hangover, which is a tremendous success and which is all credit to the writers of that movie because they came up with something that people wanted to see. And then you have the opposite of the spectrum, which is Stretch Armstrong, on which, quite frankly, whoever writes it is probably going to be interchangeable and it's going to end up being a cabal of writers at different stages. So I think the writers who are taking advantage of the moment we're in right now are the writers who can also multitask as directors and producers
mm-hmm.
so that they can deliver all the tools for introducing their concepts to the public. But largely speaking, for the rank and file screenwriter, it's pretty bad right now.
Well, forgive me if this is a convoluted question, which it very well might be.
Well, please go ahead. That was a convoluted answer.
But you talk about some of the films that we're seeing today and how they tailor nostalgia for certain subjects and pair it up with a star and then write the script based on that. If you want to be a working screenwriter today, would you suggest writing one of these kinds of trend movies? Because, I noticed that the trend this year especially seems to be 80s nostalgia, A-Team, Karate Kid. It's on and on and on that we're going to see throughout the year. And try to find a heart in that and your personal voice in that, or just write from the heart for you?
Well, I think you've answered your own question, and this is a theme that a lot of writers in the project speak to. And this is something that I really hope I can help communicate to other writers out there, because this is the blind alley that so many aspiring screenwriters go down. I think Paul Schrader makes this remark in the book, and I think he says it really well. He says, if you, the writer, are looking at what is a hit in theaters today and saying, I can emulate that, you have to realize that every other person who wants to sell a screenplay just had the same idea. So development executives 6 months from now are going to be deluged with copies of whatever is popular right now. Therefore, you are competing with a lot of other people. And as Schrader said, they may be better positioned than you. They may already have agents. They may be better writers because they've been doing it longer. They may have relationships with producers. So you're really trying to break yourself out of a gigantic pack, but you're not actually trying to break yourself out of the pack because you're doing exactly what everybody else in the pack is doing. So the second half of what Schrader says, which I think is a really powerful bit of advice, is instead of trying to chase trends or instead of trying to predict what the marketplace is going to want because the marketplace is so fickle, why don't you look deep into yourself and discover what it is about the way you see the world that is so unique that it is unlike the way anybody else sees the world. And he can really back this up because the movies that made Schrader famous, The Yakuza, Taxi Driver, Rolling Thunder, Hardcore, those couldn't have come from anybody else. They really come out of his soul. They speak to the dark turmoil that goes inside his, that happens inside his being. He was able to find dramatic mechanisms to put his inner self onto the screen, and that's what spoke to people when they saw his work for the first time. They said, this is a writer with a unique viewpoint.
Yeah.
Whatever movie we make of his scripts is not going to be like every other movie that comes out. It may be less commercial by definition, but it will at least have the merit of being unusual. And I think that's the best advice you can offer to someone trying to get noticed as a screenwriter, is demonstrate to people how you can be unusual, and part and parcel with that, find a way to deliver what is unusual about you in a conventional format. And here's what I mean by that. If you want to write a really esoteric story, write it in a conventional fashion, because what you have now told the person reading that screenplay is that you can take really difficult material and you can present it in such a way that anyone can understand it and anyone can grasp what's exciting about it. Whereas if, let's say, you are a fan of those 80s TV shows and you decide that as a spec script to show off what you can do, you're going to adapt the old TV show Manimal to try and tap into 80s nostalgia, you're spiting yourself in two different ways, which is, number one, you don't own the rights to that property, and number two, you're just telling someone reading your script that you don't have any original ideas of your own. So that, I think, is a really important theme that people in the project communicate to other writers, which is chasing trends is really dangerous and usually doesn't work.
Well, you talk about Paul Schrader. One of my favorite episodes of this show that we've done was an interview that we did with Paul Schrader. And you can tell, obviously, this man is a writer through and through. He started out a big diatribe about the death of cinema, and it was just so beautifully articulate and persuasive. I was just absolutely won over by him. So we read the interviews in the book. We see the interviews in your film. Were there any moments that stood out for you outside of what we read on the page or see on the screen with these talents that you interviewed?
The one that always comes to mind is, of course, a William Goldman story. Getting Goldman was really the top of the mountain for me. I felt that if I got Goldman, this project was a personal success, and if I didn't get Goldman, this project was personally unfinished. And that takes nothing away from the dozens of other fantastically wonderful and talented people who participated in the project, but there's every other screenwriter in the world, and there's Bill Goldman, at least in my perspective, because...
Right.
In addition to that monumental body of work, Marathon Man, All the President's Men, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, Princess Bride, on down the line, there are all those wonderful books and essays and commentary about the madness of the film industry. So he's really been a personal hero of mine for so long that when I was able to sit down with him and chat with him in his home, it was an out-of-body experience. And the anecdote that I don't have on camera or even recorded, but that is very memorable to me, is this. After I had interviewed him, I was taking Bill's photograph, and we're just chatting while I'm setting up the lighting. And I think this would have been mid-2008, so he was relating a story that had happened probably in 2007. Bill's waiting to get his picture taken, and he says, do you want to hear my Obama story? So, of course, I'm going to say yes. I want to hear his Obama story. So he says that this happened probably in 2007. he and his girlfriend were on a receiving line at a meet and greet with then-Senator Obama. Bill's girlfriend gets to the head of the line, meets the senator, says, "Senator Obama, I'd like you to meet Bill Goldman. He wrote one of the great political films of all time, All the President's Men." Obama clasps Goldman's hand and says, "Not only that, he wrote Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. Bill, I don't think they pay enough attention to screenplays in Hollywood anymore. What do you think?"
Wow. That's a good politician.
Wow, I like to believe it.
Wow.
I like to believe it.
Tell me, now they can order the book and the film on your website, talesfromthescript.org, right?
Yeah, there's actually a couple different ways to access the project. The book is available everywhere. It's available in bookstores. It's available on Amazon. It's called Tales from the Script. 50 Hollywood screenwriters share their stories. The movie comes out on March 12th in New York City and then March 19th in L.A. before coming out on DVD April 20th. You can pre-order the DVD through the project site, which is talesfromthescript.com,
mm-hmm.
and I'm widely available, so I'm going to be out there stumping for the movie. Actually, you know what? Just stop it after the .com. I don't know why I went on that other tear at the end.
I wanted to ask you something else about the project. Obviously, you come from a screenwriting and directing background. It is your life. So in speaking to all of these people, what did you learn?
The best lesson I took away from this project was the simplest lesson, which is to make movies that you, the creator of that film, would pay money to see. For a number of years, I did exactly what people shouldn't do. I came out to Hollywood and I chased trends. I tried to write scripts that I thought were commercial. I tried to put myself in the box of writing an action movie, a horror movie, a comedy, trying to write what I thought the marketplace wanted. And I encountered a fair amount of indifference. Generally, the compliments were, this is very good writing, this is good character work, this is good dialogue, but the story just doesn't excite us. And I think what I learned from that, in retrospect, is that I was writing stories that didn't excite me. I was writing stories that I thought would excite other people. After sitting down with dozens of professional writers and hearing what worked for them and what didn't work for them, mm-hmm. the really powerful through line is that the movies they have made that have most broadly connected with Hollywood people, with audiences, with themselves, are the stories that come from very deep inside of them. And they can still be popcorn entertainment, they can still be light entertainment, but the guiding principle has to be, would you, the writer, pay money to see this movie? Is this a movie that you think needs to be in the world?
Yeah.
I was able to apply that directly to my work, so immediately after finishing the book and the movie, I wrote a new original spec, and it's gotten the best reaction of anything I've written. It's got producers attached, and it's looking really good to go into production in a year or so with me directing. So I hope I'm a good test case for the validity of the advice in this project.
Yeah, absolutely. And when that project comes to fruition, I want you to come back and tell us all about it.
I look forward to it.
Before I let you go, I always like to ask this question to close off conversations. Three essential screenplays. If you were to recommend them, which ones would they be?
I would probably always recommend Thelma and Louise by Kelly Curry.
Mm-hmm.
I think I might recommend Bugsy by James Toback.
Oh, yeah.
And off the top of my head, I might recommend Badlands by Terrence Malick.
Yeah. All three very different kinds of qualities that these screenplays have. What stands out for you for, say, a Badlands?
I think what all three have is that they are unique personal statements. And with Badlands particularly, it has the added benefit of being one of the best examples I can think of pure screenwriting economy.
Mm-hmm.
This is, of course, basing a lot of the appraisal on the finished film, which I think is fair to do for a solo writer-director piece, because obviously that's pretty close to what the writer's original intention was, because he was able to protect it as the director.
Right.
But you look at that film, and there's just not a wasted note. There's not a wasted frame. It's short. It makes its point quickly. It's poetic. It's lyrical. it does all of those magical things that a movie is supposed to do. It transports you to another time, to another place, to another psyche. But it does it with such efficiency and grace that it reminds you that it's not always the most words, but it's always the best chosen words that have the greatest effect.
Yeah. Yeah, and I find that it's what's left unspoken in a screenplay. It's kind of the life you fill in between the lines that matters in a way.
A great example in Thelma and Louise. We never find out what happened in Texas. Mm-hmm. I believe it's Louise who keeps saying, "You don't want to get caught in Texas," meaning that something happened to her in the past in Texas that was horrific and traumatic. We, the viewer, don't need to know. Because
yeah.
I think what Curry understands as a storyteller is that if she makes that literal and specific, she says, this is exactly what happened to this character, it limits the power of our imagination, and it limits the power of that statement. The statement has power because it forces us to imagine the most horrible thing that could happen to us, and we
mm-hmm.
can imprint that on the character. We just don't need that information to understand what she's going through. We need to understand that she feels fear. And
yeah.
what that writing choice allows Curry to do is to let us imprint our own fear onto the character. And because screenwriting is, by definition, such a reductive form of writing, the tendency, I think, in conventional Hollywood screenwriting, which is too often learned out of books and learned out of academic study instead of coming from a literary tradition, the tendency is just to explain things to death, to answer every question that a movie raises. And I think the movies that really stay with me are the ones that raise more questions than they ask, so long as they don't get lost in a mire of pointless ambiguity. I think there's
right.
provocative ambiguity and pointless ambiguity, and I think Thelma is a great example of provocative ambiguity.
That was author, producer, director Peter Hansen talking about the art of screenwriting. He has a documentary and a companion book called Tales from the Script coming out, 50 Conversations with Screenwriters. Gary, are you with me?
Hey, yeah, I'm here. That was fascinating.
Good stuff there, man.
That was really good stuff. I like those are three really original choices to pick for screenplay.
I do love the highlight is the Obama story.
That's a great story. That's a wonderful story. No, but that was a really good interview. He brought up a very good point, though, about, you know, if you basically doing like writing a remake or doing someone else's property, which you already have the things with the prop, you know, the rights and everything, but it does show right off the bat that you don't have an original idea. I mean,
right.
It's really, he's absolutely right. That is a dangerous, a really dumb thing to do if you're trying to make in that business. Why would anybody want to, you know, take a risk on you if you can't even come up with at least the first thing should always be your something that you've come up with, I think.
I mean, for every fugitive, there's, you know, there's a car 54, where are you?
Exactly, yeah. I mean, that's a very good point. That was a really good interview. That was really informative. I appreciated that.
Yeah, it's good stuff. And as he said, opens up in New York on Friday, L.A. on the 19th,
mm-hmm.
and the book is already available, and comes out on DVD in mid-late April,
right.
I believe. So could be some good stuff there. Looking forward to that.
One thing we didn't touch on, and we mentioned it, but we didn't touch on it, is the sudden delay of Wall Street 2, Money Never Sleeps, from April to September.
Speaking of, you know, it's funny, you know, we were having a conversation for the interview talking about the 80s, and,
yeah.
you know, they talked about it here, and so I guess, yeah, Wall Street, Money Never Sleeps being moved from April to September.
Yeah.
I'm a little disappointed because I was looking forward to
mm-hmm.
it.
Likewise.
But they want to move it to the fall for, I guess, a couple of reasons. One, obviously, they feel they want to have their big premiere at the Cannes Film Festival, which
mm-hmm.
would be pretty cool. And I guess they think that at the very least they can get a nomination for Michael Douglas again for the same role. Which,
right.
I have no problem with that move. You know, I would love to see it now.
Yeah.
But,
it's so all of a sudden, because they already started like the promotional push, because Michael Douglas is on the cover of the latest Vanity Fair. So I'm sure they're not, you know, crazy about the Vanity Fair. It's probably like, oh, great. You know, now we're very early with that. But let me ask you this. Do you think there's something wrong with the film? Mickey Fink, I think, had suggested that there might be something wrong with the film.
I don't think so. You know, I make it a, you know, this is just me. I make it a point not to read Mickey Fink.
No, I understand. Dude, I understand that. I completely... I'm just telling you, there are a couple of places, and that was, I think, where it started. But my thing is, the only film it was competing against on April 23rd was The Backup Plan. I don't really see that being the competition. So I must assume you're right that they think that this is definitely an award contender. They want the Cannes premiere and all that. So
not only that, but you know, there's this thing. At least I would, you know, the trailer that's out there for Wall Street, it makes it, you know. I'm actually very optimistic. I think it's going to be a lot of fun, just like working on Wall Street is a lot of fun. And frankly, April 23rd, I mean, let's be honest, that only gives the film 1 week before the summer starts.
Well,
I mean, because the summer starts.
Yeah, the summer, but the May 7th is when Iron Man 2 comes out, so at best it would have 2 weeks.
Yeah.
But no, I understand what you're saying. I mean, yeah, I mean, September, maybe, I do think, although people do say when they're releasing it in September is also kind of like a dead time, too. But and remember, the following week it has The Social Network, Your Highness, and one other film that opens. I'm not saying that those would be direct. I think The Social Network could be its competition, the Fincher film. But
and the Fincher film is actually October 15th.
Oh,
so,
okay.
I mean,
I thought they moved it up.
I still see it as October 15th. Ironically, I think that's the same release date as Fight Club back in 99.
Oh, well, remember, Fight Club was a dud. I mean, not critically. I mean, it's one of my favorite movies, but did not do well when it opened.
I have a feeling, and I wouldn't be surprised if Wall Street does, it has its, one of the premieres, probably. I wouldn't be surprised if Wall Street goes to Toronto.
Oh, I think that they're aiming for that. I think with not only Cannes, but I think they're aiming. They really want to have the Toronto premiere.
Toronto and or New York. Now that I think about it, the New York Film Festival would seem a little more.
Yeah, New York, and also what about? Isn't Venice also?
Yeah, Venice is in August.
Yeah.
So you know, I can see going to Venice, and I can see going to the, you know. Wall Street at the New York Film Festival seems kind of inevitable.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, as a possibility anyways.
Right.
So,
no, I think those are all viable and I think valid things to shoot for. Because you're right. I mean, April 23rd, it does seem like an odd time to release. I don't care what anyone says. This is a high-profile sequel. I'm very curious to see how Gordon Gekko fares in today's. He gets out of jail, and all this after all this time. I just want to see him in action. How he seemed compared to what comes after him. He seems like a saint. So it's going to be fascinating to see what Stone does with this character.
Yeah, and frankly, people may laugh at this, but Shia LaBeouf looks better in the role that he has than frankly. Charlie Sheen did in his role. Charlie Sheen was actually kind of outmatched in the original Wall Street, but Shia LaBeouf looks very engaged, and I think it'll be a nice maturation for him as an actor.
We'll see. I think anything's possible with this film, so I'm very curious. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah. So I don't see it as a red flag. I see it as
Okay, frankly, that's good.
I remember when they started filming Wall Street, I had assumed that they were going to do it was going to be a fall Oscar kind of film. And then I remember when I heard, no, they're going to release it in the spring. I must admit, when I first heard that, I thought that was actually kind of odd. So this
seems like a fall movie, really, more of a fall film, a serious, you know.
Right.
Film, so yeah, I definitely see. That it does make sense in what they're trying to do, and what they definitely want to make it an awards contender too. So
yeah, so Before we close out, Jerry, what are you going to see this weekend? Anything?
I'm going to try to see Green Zone, the Paul Greengrass movie. I'm really curious about that.
Green Zone, all right.
Yeah. I'm trying to think if there's anything else. I guess Greenberg is next week around
Greenberg.
Here.
Can't wait for the Armand White review.
Oh, God. All right. Before we close out, because we're not going to be on Sunday, and I don't know if we're going to be on next Wednesday. I think, to be on the safe side, I think we will be back on a week from Sunday. But why don't you go ahead and explain to people about the Armand White concert?
Armand White, who's been a guest on Movie Geeks United for our De Palma show, has never been a fan of Noah Baumbach's films. His films include Kicking and Screaming and from 1995, Mr. Jealousy, Squid and the Whale, Margot at the Wedding.
Now
Greenberg is coming up with Ben Stiller and a score by LCD Sound System. Looks really good, really interesting.
I can't wait to see it. I mean, I'm really excited.
Can't wait to see it. Well, Armand never liked Noah Baumbach's films. Fair enough. Well, he got turned away, apparently, at a press screening of Greenberg. Supposedly, he was banned by the publicist of the film for Focus Features.
Mm-hmm.
A anonymous email started circulating saying that that fellow critics should unite and try to protest this in favor of Armand. But then it turned out people brought up this old urban legend, apparently, that Armand at one point had said that Noah Baumbach's mother should have aborted him. And also a little more background, Noah Baumbach's mother is the film critic Georgia Brown for The Village Voice back in the 80s
Right, that is, you're right, yeah.
And Armand and her have had a long-standing feud. So there was this urban legend that Armand said she should have aborted her son. And no one could find this. This was always found on message boards, but no one could find this quote or whatever. So it had been debunked. It had been proven as they'd seen as an urban legend and, you know, so forth. Well, today, someone went down to the New York Public Library, went into the stacks of the Village Voice, found Armand White's 1998 review of Mr. Jealousy, which had not been on the Internet because this was pre-Internet, and it got reprinted by Jay Hoberman in a column at the Village Voice blog. And the last line of Mr. Jealousy, the review, which Armand hates, says, "Mr. Jealousy suggests retroactive abortion." So there it is, folks. So I guess to think so, but apparently the ban has been lifted. Armand will be seeing Greenberg on Friday. His review will probably appear in next week on NewYorkPress.com. Be interesting to see what he thinks. Some people have raised the question, despite all of this ugliness, have raised the obvious question is, should Armand White even be reviewing Noah Baumbach films at this point?
Well, I think I don't.
Not that impartiality is anything that has to do with criticism, obviously.
Right.
But it does seem that because of this past history and some of these comments, that it probably seems that Armand White is never going to like a Noah Baumbach film.
Well, I mean, I don't, that's really up to someone to make that decision. I mean, I wouldn't, look, I disagree with Armand a lot. I mean, many times, and when he was on the show, I disagreed with a lot of things that he had said, but I think he has a right to review whatever he wants to review.
Mm-hmm.
I will say that. I mean, let's put it like this. I think the bigger thing, what if he sees it and actually likes it? Which doubtful, but you never know.
Some people have thrown it out there that Armand White being Armand White, there is the possibility that he might actually say something along the lines that Noah Baumbach has matured as a filmmaker.
Yeah, I mean, you can't rule that out. I think that would be a horrible thing to say, oh, you shouldn't review that, because you could have made the same argument with Vincent Canby, because he loved Woody Allen. But you say, well, he shouldn't be, because he's always going to give Woody Allen a great review. You could have made that same argument.
But the difference is, let's be honest, Armand did cross a line.
Oh, he did. He did. I mean, since now that that's true, that he did say that, he did. But I don't know if I want to set that precedent. But I think that's something I can't believe I'm coming out. This is the second time this year, in less than a year, that I've defended Armand White. Oh, my God. But it's not. I think what he said is reprehensible. But I don't know if I want to set this thing that he can't review it. But I think there is a thing that if you really don't like this guy's films, maybe you shouldn't. It's like, it would be like sending me into, or, all right, this is a review from 2005 in the New Yorker. Anthony Lane reviewed Revenge of the Sith. And clearly the tone of his review, you know he doesn't like the Star Wars movies at all. And you're wondering, well, maybe they should let someone else review it.
Right. Well, I mean, that to me is different. If someone's just not a fan of the series,
right.
I'm talking, you know, but if Anthony Lane had said, you know, I wish George Lucas had been aborted back in the early
40s. Yeah, no, I see what you're saying, and you're right. That's the better point to bring up. When I read this, I didn't know about this till a couple of days ago, that there's this thing that he had supposedly said this, and now, as you say, Jay Hoberman has pointed out he did. Maybe he'd just be better if, but he's such, Armand is such a troublemaker. I don't see him not reviewing it.
By the way, in page 6 of the New York Post, Armand denied, this was before Jay Hoberman posted his story, Armand denied making those comments.
Oh, God. Okay. This thing's getting worse and worse in the last 5 minutes.
All I know is I wish I was in New York at the Friday press screening. That's all I wish.
Okay. Well, we'll soon find out.
I'm sure we will get updates on Armand's. I'm sure on Armand's viewing of Greenberg, and if he even remotely chuckles, who knows what that will entail?
If he chuckles, then I think that humanity has a chance. Then
I'm just excited not only because it's a new Noah Baumbach film, but as I just found out a couple of days ago, LCD Sound System did the score.
Yeah. It's really good.
Anyone who's heard their first, you know, their first two albums, their self-titled debut album and Sound of Silver, which came out 3 years ago, and they have a new album coming out soon.
Mm-hmm.
They're one of the best, you know, outfits out there. Very, very eclectic music, kind of very Talking Heads, circa Remain in Light.
Mm-hmm.
No,
they're good, very good, and an excellent choice to score the film.
So I'm
looking forward to the soundtrack. I'm just looking forward to the film. I'm just like the story. It seems like, to me, at least, of all of Baumbach's films, this is almost like, just from what I've read so far and what the characters are, sort of seems like an unofficial sequel to Kicking and Screaming in some ways.
Yeah, and that's what gets me to. I love Kicking and Screaming.
Isn't that a good movie? That's such a good movie.
I think it's one of the best films ever made about post-college life.
It's a really, really good film. I'm glad to hear that you like it, because a lot of people, when it came out, weren't crazy about it. And I was just like, are you nuts? First of all, it's got Chris Eigman in it, who I miss, who I haven't seen in that many movies lately, but he was good in that film, and Mr. Jealousy, and the Whit Stillman movies, and...
Now, do pick up, and you can pick up Kicking and Screaming from the Criterion Collection.
Yes, I'm a proud owner of that.
So there's some good stuff on there. And Baumbach has also, he's a close friend and collaborator with Wes Anderson, having worked on Life Aquatic and Fantastic Mr. Fox.
That's right. All really good stuff.
Multi-talented guy. So Greenberg, looking forward to that, and looking forward to Armand's review.
Yes.
So, well, Jamie, I think that's going to do it. I'm going to go get some leftovers.
Okay, great. This was a good show, and I want to thank everyone for listening. I want to thank you, Aaron, for filling in on short notice. It was a real pleasure to have you on, and good conversations, and Jamie did
good
a great
stuff.
Job for the interview. And I hope everyone has a great weekend, and we will let you we're thinking either next Wednesday night or a week from Sunday, Movie Geeks United will be back on, but we won't be on this Sunday, though.
Won't be on this Sunday. We'll be back next week at some point, and
right.
I'm sure Jamie will join us. And also thank you for everyone in the chat room. I miss the futurist. Where is the futurist?
I don't know what happened to him. I haven't seen him lately. I know he still has a blog on Blogger somewhere, but I haven't seen him at all lately. The last year or so.
Miss the futurist, but that's another story.
That is another story. All right.
Well, I will talk to you soon, Jamie.
Okay.
See Gary.
Yeah.
You're cool, man.
All right. You too. Thanks. Good night, everyone.
Right. Good night, everyone.
Thank you. Thank you.